What do these three things have in common? Or I should say, what's the difference between among these three things? Unicorns, dragons, and pirates. Well,
they're the stuff of legends,
but the difference is that the pirates that you know about didn't really exist, whereas unicorns and dragons likely did. For most Americans, their idea, their view of pirates, at least in my generation, is informed by, well, in the current generation too especially, but in a little different way, is actually informed by Hollywood, by film. There have been over 70 pirate movies made in the 20th century and the early 21st century. For the modern generation, pirates are exemplified by Captain Jack Sparrow. Now, I don't know if you've seen Pirates of the Caribbean. I'm not going to recommend it to you necessarily. But the modern generation in our popular culture, Captain Jack Sparrow, is pirates. And if you know anything about those films, you know that he is a ridiculous, absurd, essentially harmless figure who consorts with dead pirates, some of whom have already gone to Davy Jones's locker and have been reincarnated. That's the kind of idea that people have, the modern generation has of pirates. Now, when I was growing up, it was the swashbuckling hero types, men of adventure, men who had run afoul of the law, and unjustly so, and they were kind of forced into attacking their enemies on ships, and they were always the underdog, and they were always the one who had been unjustly served, typically by the British government, sometimes by the American government, and they had taken to the high seas. Now, the image of pirates for most people comes from primarily two books, Treasure Island and Peter Pan. And for the previous generation, Peter Pan exemplifies with, of course, Captain Hook and Shmi and all the characters of that pirate crew. Again, semi-comical, ridiculous figures, bloodthirsty, but pretty much off camera, and you know nobody's really going to get hurt. And then Treasure Island, the classic book. And in that book, all the pirates get it in the neck before the end, except for Long John Silver, who has a streak of goodness in there. At least he has sort of a, you have sort of a puckish admiration for him, and you just don't want him to get killed, and he doesn't. Robert Louis Stevenson lets Long John Silver sail off into the sunset. But the reality of pirates and piracy is far different from the Hollywood version. Had the men of the early 1700s, were they living today, they would recognize what today is called terrorists and terrorism as the pirates of their day, having moved forward. Because pirates pretty much were interested in two things: stealing stuff and murdering people, and all the things that go along with that. Burning down towns, carrying off women, murdering all males on a ship. Some of them were vicious desperados who bragged of how many officers and how many seamen that they themselves had murdered in the course of their depredations. They're different from today's terrorists in that the pirates did not blow themselves up. They blew up everybody else. And plunder, of course, was the primary desire, but any means at their disposal to accomplish that is what they is what they did. Now, some of our images of pirates are actually very true. And I've not been to this pirate museum today, so I don't know what sort of image they're going to portray. My guess is it's going to be a pretty broad spectrum, the idea of popular culture as well as the reality of the old-time pirates. But the actual reality is there's really not much to admire in them, and though mythological figures in some ways, there's nothing particularly admirable about most of them. In the Western Atlantic in the Caribbean in the 1720s, which was right at the height, the peak of piracy on the East Coast, around the Florida Keys, along the coast of Florida, up the coast of Georgia, and especially off of North Carolina, the peak of piracy in the Atlantic was 1720. 1720 to 1740, roughly. Most of the pirates, in fact, one historian of piracy has estimated that about 98% of the pirates were former merchant seamen or former sailors in somebody's navy. And navies in those days, in the days of wooden ships, of sailing ships, navies were composed of international crews. If you went on a British ship, you would hear seven or eight different languages being spoken. Same with an American ship, or in the 1800s. If you went on board an American ship, oftentimes a merchant ship, you would have an international crew. There's going to be, we were talking about this last night, I was talking about this with someone last night, that you would have heard Italians, there'd be Venetians and Genoese on board a typical ship. There'd be Frenchmen of all different kinds. There would be Africans who spoke languages that no one else on board had ever even heard of, much less understood. There would be ex-slaves who had liberated themselves and joined a merchant crew and eventually a pirate ship. There were very few pirate ships that did not have a significant percentage of the crew that was black. It might just be 10 men, but virtually all crews had black pirates aboard. And sometimes they were subordinates, sometimes they were slaves that were made to serve on pirate ships. But they were international crews, and they spoke all different kinds of languages. The greatest pirates, leaders of pirates, captains of ships, were typically Englishmen, but occasionally Americans, and occasionally French as well. And it was a polyglot group of characters. And actually, they had their own language that they spoke, whether they spoke French or Spanish or Dutch or English or some other language. They had their own. They had their own language that was the language of the sea. Let me just read to you. Here's a typical order aboard a wooden ship. And the words that are used have full and very particular meaning to the men who are hearing this particular order. Lift the skin up and put into the bunt the slack of the clews, not too taut, the leech and foot rope and body of the sail, being careful not to let it go forward under or hang down abaft. Then haul your bunt well up on the yard, smoothing the skin and bringing it down well abaft, and make fast the bunt gasket around the mast and the jigger, if there be one, to the tie. And that's the way their language was. Every aspect of a wooden ship had a word for it, and the seamen had nicknames for all of the parts of the ship as well. And so it was something to behold, almost a foreign language in itself, that the wooden navies and the wooden ships of the day, and in particular the pirate ships, they spoke their own language. The way the pirates looked were pretty much as they were described by Robert Louis Stevenson. I mean, that book is actually pretty accurate in this description of pirates, how they dressed, how they looked. Of course, they were all their faces and arms were burned and weathered. All pirates were kind of a nut brown color from being out in the sunlight all day long on board ships. they were covered with scars because the injuries, every day someone was injured on board a ship. It was a very dangerous enterprise. So all the men had scars and wounds that they received just from handling the sails and doing the work aboard the ship. And then when they had to fight, they would receive other wounds sometimes as well. They wore short blue jackets over checkered shirts, as Robert Louis Stevenson says, and either long canvas trousers or baggy petticoat breeches, which somewhat resembled culottes. In addition, they frequently wore red waistcoats and tied a scarf or handkerchief loosely around the neck. And you never see a self-respecting pirate without a handkerchief, either then or today. One of the stereotypes of pirates is that most of the captains were men of nobility. You know, they're nobles that went rogue, that, you know, men of aristocratic blood that went over the hill and joined the dark side. And that was usually not the case. Now, there were several men who fit that description, actually, but only a couple. Most of these men were just men who had attained leadership through their cleverness, their immediate and final violence to anybody who challenged them. And that's how they came to be the cutthroat heroes that they were. Now, Errol Flynn and Douglas Fairbanks were the ones that I was most familiar with growing up. That doesn't mean I lived in the 1930s when their movies were made, but that's what you could see on black and white television in the 1950s. And I admired Errol Flynn and Douglas Fairbanks as pirates. My view of pirates was kind of shaped by those two characters who played pirates frequently in the movies. Captain Blood is a great movie. Captain Blood, in fact, I believe he was caught up in the Reformation. He was sympathetic to reformers. I think like during the English Civil War or something, he treated some wounded Puritan soldiers. He was a doctor. And Charles II had him sent to the Dry Tortugas or someplace as a slave. And being a doctor and being a leader of men, at the same time, he was able to escape his bondage and became a pirate. He became Captain Blood. But of course, he was a swashbuckler. He was a nice guy. He treated his enemies as a gentleman would. It was just the perfect Hollywood version of the poor pirate who was put upon by the government and forced into piracy. He was actually a pretty nice guy. Some pirates wore fancy clothes. John Stowe noted two pirates facing execution in 1615. And they gave away their fancy clothes, which included breeches of crimson taffeta, velvet doublets with gold buttons, and velvet shirts with gold lace. Pirate captains seem to have adopted the clothes of naval officers or merchant sea captains. Many pirate captains fancied themselves the equal of any British sea captain. Some of the very worst pirates, the ones who committed the greatest of depredations, one of them was a man named Bartholomew Roberts. And you may have run across him. I mean, he was a real character, really a bad guy, but you may have run across him in Princess Bride, another fine pirate movie. one of my favorite movies. Maybe you don't watch movies, but if you ever watch Princess Bride, the Dread Pirate Roberts. Well, there really was a Dread Pirate Roberts. He was kind of the ideal of pirates of those days, but his name was Bartholomew Roberts. But he was not the clean-cut hero portrayed by Errol Flynn in any way. He was tough, he was ruthless, he was savage, and he was cruel. And that is what characterized most pirates. And you know, today in our own society and culture, there is a very strong tendency to call good evil and evil good. And you know, the image of pirates and piracy is one of those things where evil is called good. Now, that's not true of terrorists, but they're not viewed in the same they're not viewed in the same context for a number of different reasons. But real pirates really were exactly that. They preyed upon the innocent. They stole from everybody that had any kind of substance and wealth, and they murdered without compunction. Some of them tortured as before they murdered their victims. And there are a number of them whose names in their day were very well known. In fact, I came to know a number of these pirates when I was, I'm not that old really, but when I was a young boy, probably about 11, 12 years old, there was kind of a rage of collectible cards, bubblegum cards. Everybody's familiar with baseball cards, right? And I collected baseball cards and football cards, and I collected all sorts of things. But one of the runs that the bubblegum company came out with were pirate cards. And I bought a bunch of pirate cards, and I collected pirate cards. And each one was a different famous pirate, which would, on the back, would tell you all the personal information about them, and there'd be sort of an artist's rendering of the pirate on the cover. And so when I was young, me and my friends would sit around and we'd talk about pirates. They had Civil War cards, by the way, too. Two different kinds of sets. I've got them all. I spent my parents' last dime buying Civil War cards until I had them all. See, you don't get them all. When you buy two packs, you might get doubles. And so then you trade them. They're called trading cards, and you trade them around until you get all of them. And there are probably some people that still remember, you know, me sitting on their back and strangling them till they traded that last card I needed to have. So, but I also had pirate cards. In the early 1960s, Beatles cards were popular. And my sister had a few of those, but they went by the wayside pretty quick. Well, the most memorable description of any pirate in history was Blackbeard. Captain Johnson's General History of the Pirates is the book that's quoted by everybody. I've never actually seen a copy of it. It's an old book that was written at the time, but he describes various pirates and their depredations. This particular character, his name is Captain Teach. His name was Teach. And he really was perhaps one of the most legendary pirates of all time. Everybody's heard of Blackbeard. Walt Disney made several movies of Blackbeard, Blackbeard's ghost. And of course, he's a jovial old guy who really, he was menacing, but he really wouldn't hurt anybody. Captain William Teach would hurt people. But he became known as Blackbeard, and there's a real good reason why that was. His beard was black, which he suffered to grow to an extravagant length. As to breadth, it came up to his eyes. He was accustomed to twist it with ribbons and small tails, after the manner of our Romilly's wigs, and turn them about around his ears. In time of action, he wore a sling over his shoulders, with three brace of pistols hanging in holsters like bandoliers, and stuck lighted matches under his hat, which appeared on each side of his face. His eyes, naturally looking fierce and wild, made him altogether such a figure that imagination cannot form an idea of a fury from hell to look more frightful. So Blackbeard played it to the hilt, just as if he was a Hollywood actor. He was ferocious, and I'm going to tell you the story of his end, as a matter of fact, which is a fairly typical end of most pirates. The practice of going into action armed to the teeth is true of pirates. Artifacts recovered from sunken pirate ships have revealed that pirates were the best armed men in the world, better than even naval figures. Most pirates were young men in their 20s. The average age of a pirate in the early 18th century, the 1700s, was 27, which is also the exact average age of the merchant seaman in the 18th century. So sailing the high seas, whether as a pirate or a merchant seaman or as a sailor in the Navy, age 27 was the average age of these men because the physical demands were so huge. It required agility, fitness, stamina, a certain amount of physical strength, and an ability to put up with extreme discomfort above and below deck. And the men in the Buccaneer ships, whether French or British, were men like such as that. One of the most famous pirates, the first famous pirate, was a man named Henry Morgan. He was a Welshman. In 1668, he attacked the Spanish treasure port of Portobello. In his crew, 40 of them were Dutchmen. Several were French, Italian, Portuguese, mulatto, or black, and the remainder were British. French privateers sailed the Caribbean and caused a great deal of havoc as well. So British and French. A British pirate attacked St. Augustine and, in fact, burnt the city. And that spurred the Spaniards to increase the building and improve the building of their fort, defending the city. American pirates came from Boston, Charleston, Newport, New York, Salem, and other East Coast ports. Today, most American pirates come from Washington, D.C. In any case, let me skip ahead here. I don't want to take too much time on this for you. Everybody's heard of Captain Kidd, of course, as well as Henry Morgan. Henry Morgan, by the way, one of the great pirates of all time, became a multimillionaire, and he retired. He retired to Jamaica, and when he died, he was a multimillionaire, and his estate included 109 black slaves. So Henry Morgan had a long and distinguished piratical career and lived to old age and died in his bed. But that was extremely rare, and of course that made him even more famous because it spurred others into piracy, saying, well, this can be done successfully, I can become a rich man, and I can survive to old age. As far as I know, he's the only one who did. All the rest of them died violently, often at the hands of federal officers or at the hands of naval officers, Captain Kidd included. Well, I was going to tell you about some of the interesting pirate films, but I think I'll skip through that. I'm guessing that there'll be some of these things at the Pirate Museum. And like I said, in previous generations, Captain Hook was the sort of the beau ideal of pirates. Well, let me talk a little bit about the difference between pirates and privateers. This is a distinction that needs to be made if we're going to be historically accurate, but it's somewhat problematic in that there is a fine line between piracy and privateering. And sometimes pirates are called privateers and sometimes the other way around. And usually it depends on whose ox is being gored as to whether they're pirates or privateers. A privateer is a man who has been given a letter of marque, letter of marque, M-A-R-Q-U-E. Letter of marque is an official document given by a government to a pirate, to somebody who wants to raid enemy shipping, enemy merchant shipping, typically in a war, in a declared war. So when England and France went to war, the King of England would issue letters of marque because actually Britain didn't have a formal navy for quite a while. I mean, right up until the 18th century. Well, up until after 1589 or 1588. You know, the battle with the Spanish Armada, we talk about the English navy, but it was all privateers. They were entrepreneurs. They were investors. They owned ships. They purchased cannons. They hired crews. And they operated independent of everybody else. They flew the British flag, but there was no navy until after 1588, when the crown decided to have to begin developing a formal naval presence or a formal naval force. Before that, it was all privateers. It was private enterprise, as it were. Men who had the means to go out and prey on enemy shipping. And so a privateer was someone who had received a letter of marque from a monarch or from a formal government, which gave them permission to attack enemy merchant shipping in time of war. They were called privateers. They owned their own ships, they owned their crews, they paid their crews from the prize money. When you took an enemy merchant ship, it was called a prize, and that you could take it to a prize port, and you could sell the ship and sell whatever was in the ship, and then you divided the money between the crew, among the crew, and as a captain yourself getting the lion's share, but then the rest, a certain percentage, maybe 50%, whatever it is, would go to your investors, whoever put up the money to establish your privateering. So there were many pirates who claimed to be privateers. It's just that they forgot the part about the letter of marque and the part about having to be at war with the enemy country. But privateering was considered a legitimate enterprise by all the European states. I was telling someone last night that when the American Civil War broke out, the Confederate government announced that it was going to issue letters of marque to privateers to prey on Yankee shipping. And Jefferson Davis had to be the one to sign the letters of marque because he had to look over each application because pirates right away apply for letters of marque so they can ply their trade legally. So Jefferson Davis had to weed through all the applications for letters of marque to prey on Yankee shipping. And he got two requests from Massachusetts. Which I find highly ironic. I mean, don't you? I mean, the money, after all, is money to Yankees, and they applied for letters of marque to prey on their own selves, which actually probably makes sense. But they were not issued letters of marque, the Yankee merchants that applied for it. But letters of marque were very important, and we know that in one historical case, When the first Africans were brought to Jamestown in Virginia, they had been taken on the high seas from a Portuguese slaving ship. These were slaves that had been purchased by the Portuguese in Africa. They were taking them to Brazil, and they got picked off by two English ships. One of those English ships had a letter of marque from the King of Holland, and the other one did not. Theirs had expired, and so they were illegal. They were pirates. And they're the ones who captured the Portuguese ship, took off the slaves, and took them to Jamestown, Virginia, and sold them. They were first Africans in the English colony. And as it turned out, it was done illegally because the ship that took them did not have an up-to-date letter of marque. And the result was that a very highly placed Englishman who sponsored those ships like that was thrown into prison in England because it was considered an act of piracy against Portugal. And the English king, in this case James I, took a very dim view of piracy, unlike his predecessor, Queen Elizabeth, who always had a percentage in every privateer. She called everybody privateers as long as she got a cut. And if she got a percentage, then they were privateers. She did not issue them letters of marque. But, and I'm going to tell you about one of those men. In fact, the classic example of a privateer was a man who sailed under an English flag. His name was Francis Drake. And he and his cousin and his brothers and others preyed on the Spanish Main. They sailed along the coast of Florida. As a matter of fact, he laid siege to St. Augustine. And one of the reasons that he was so successful, or one of the reasons other than the fact that he was super aggressive and would land his ships and attack Spanish ports with his sailors running down the streets of a Spanish port with their cutlasses and their pistols and looking for wherever the treasure was located. But he was also a very devout Christian. Now, some would take issue with that, but he was a man who Francis Drake was a man who held prayer meetings daily on his ship. He had a chaplain who preached gospel messages to his crews. He did not use foul language. He hated the Roman Catholic Church, and that was one of the reasons that he prayed on the Spaniards. He didn't pray for them, he prayed on them. And he did so with great success, and he picked off a number of treasure fleets and treasure ships and that sort of thing. But Elizabeth always got a cut from Francis Drake. And I mentioned the other day that the Spanish ambassador was always pleading, because they were not at war with Spain. The Spanish ambassador was always pleading with Elizabeth to do something about Francis Drake. I was trying to think of what the Spanish called him, and it just came to my mind. They called him the Draken, the dragon, because they couldn't catch him, and he defeated them wherever he faced them. He was just the most aggressive, successful. Now, from the Spanish point of view, he was a pirate, because they were not at war with England until Spain declared war on England and sent the Spanish Armada to restore England to Mother Church. But it didn't work out that way for them. But prior to that, they were not officially at war, yet Francis Drake and his cousin Hawkins and others were praying on Spanish ships with the approval of Elizabeth on this hand. On the other hand, she's telling the Spanish that they will be punished. I've never issued a letter of marque. These men are rogues. We will do something about them. And what she actually did about it was she knighted Francis Drake and said, don't forget, I get 50%. And so she played both sides of the fence. But so he had official approval from the Queen of England to do what he did. So in England, he was considered a bold and resourceful privateer. In Spain, he was the worst pirate that anybody had ever invented. And Sir Francis Drake really caused a great deal of trouble on the Spanish Main. And as a matter of fact, he accomplished one of the greatest sailing feats of all time in that day. Remember Magellan in 1619, 1621, circumnavigated the world. Well, he didn't make it all the way, but one of his ships went all the way around the world. It didn't happen again until 1570 something, when Francis Drake pulled the same stunt, except that he had to do it because the entire Spanish world was after him. He'd found his way through Magellan Strait around South America and suddenly showed up in the Pacific Ocean. For the first time, an English ship in the Pacific Ocean, actually it's the second time, Jean Cabot had made it there at one time, but he made it into the Pacific Ocean going around South America, and here are all these Spanish towns in Chile and Peru and all the way up the coast to North America. And so he began paying port calls in the various Spanish places. They had no idea in the world that an Englishman had gotten into the Pacific Ocean, and he was there for a specific purpose. He was the ultimate pirate. He would go and loot town after town and fill his ship was called the Golden Hind. Hind is a dog. And the Golden Hind was filled with treasure. And then they finally took the big ship. It's called the name of the Spanish ship was the Caca Fuego. I'm not going to translate that for you, but that was the name of the treasure ship. Sailing along the coast of Chile, Drake offered a reward of a gold chain to the man who first spotted the Spanish galleon. The reward was won by his young nephew, John, who was on the lookout on the main top of the crow's nest of the Golden Hind. Drake decided to employ a tactic much used by pirates throughout the ages, fancy that, which was to disguise his ship as a slow, harmless merchantman. His crew were ordered to battle stations and all sail was set, but he reduced the speed of his ship by towing astern cables and mattresses and a line of heavy pots. San Juan de Anton, the captain of the Caca Fuego, was completely fooled. When the ships came within hailing distance as was traditional when two ships met at sea, he demanded to know the name and destination of Drake's ship. "Strike sail," was the shout across the water, "or we will send you to the bottom." The Spanish captain naturally refused to strike and ordered the Englishman to come aboard and surrender. A trumpet sounded from the Golden Hind, and a line of armed men appeared above her deck rail. The first bombardment from her guns brought down the mizzenmast of the Spanish ship, which was followed by a withering fire of arrows and musket shot, which enabled the English ship's pinnacle to come alongside the Cacafuego with a boarding party. The Spanish captain was taken prisoner and surrendered his ship. He was treated with courtesy by Drake, who told him not to distress himself, for such were the fortunes of war. And as a matter of fact, he then invited the entire officer crew of the Cacafuego to dinner, and Drake served them a wonderful dinner. They all sat around drinking wine, telling stories, maybe playing cards, but just having a great time. And then he gave each of them a gift, and then he took $1 billion worth of treasure from their ship and put it in his and dropped them off at the next port and said, "See you later, boys." And off the Golden Hind sailed with the whole Spanish fleet trying to find him. When he realized that he was in the Pacific Ocean and he had just got $1 billion worth of stuff in his hold, I mean, his ship was being overfilled with wealth, he decided to go back to England, but the only way he could make it would be to sail around the world. So he did. He sailed all across the Pacific, around India, around Africa, and showed up in port in England with himself intact and his crew. He actually had started out with 3 or 4 ships, and the others had met their fate trying to get through the Straits of Magellan and other places. But the Golden Hind made it all the way home and brought an enormous amount of treasure into the coffers of Queen Elizabeth, and she knighted Francis Drake. So he became Sir Francis Drake for raiding the Spanish Main like no one else ever had. So, like I said, there's a fine line sometimes between pirates and privateers. Strictly speaking, he was a privateer because he had the permission of his monarch to prey on enemy shipping, although there was no formal declaration of war between them. So, like I said, that's a fine line. There's no fine line for Blackbeard. He was one of the most ruthless and evil men to ever don a handkerchief around his head or lit candles next to his face. He was eventually hunted down. I'm going to talk about hunting down the pirates. I'll close with this. I just want to tell you what happened to Edward Teach. This was the report. Well, a Lieutenant Maynard, quote, "an experienced officer and a gentleman of greatest bravery and resolution," was appointed to lead the expedition. They found out where his ship was in port at Ocracoke on the Outer Banks of North Carolina. And so the in a command of a ship called the Pearl, Lieutenant Maynard went, and they found Blackbeard. He ordered Blackbeard to surrender. He and his crew, they surprised him early one morning. And of course, I won't quote to you the reply that Blackbeard gave, but it was a string of Anglo-Saxonisms. And in the end, the English naval vessel and troops boarded. Blackbeard fired a volley into the British ship, and then the sailors swung across onto the pirate ship, and they had it out by hand on the deck of the ship with Blackbeard and his crew. And in the end, the Boston newsletter described the end of Teach this way: "Maynard and Teach," remember Teach is Blackbeard, "themselves begun the fight with their swords. Maynard making a thrust, the point of his sword went into Teach's cartridge box, bending it to the hilt. Teach broke the guard of it and wounded Maynard's fingers, but did not disable him. Whereupon he jumped back and threw away his sword and fired his pistol, which wounded Teach. DeMelt struck in between them with his sword and cut Teach's face pretty much. In the interim, both companies engaged in Maynard's sloop, one of Maynard's men being a Highlander, engaged Teach with his broadsword, who gave Teach a cut on the neck, Teach saying, "Well done, lad." The Highlander replied, "It is not well done. I'll do it better." And with that, he gave him a second stroke, which cut off his head, laying it flat on his shoulder. So they took the head of Blackbeard, and they hung it up under the in the front of their ship, and then sailed the ship up to Williamsburg, Virginia, and there they collected their reward. You had to prove that you had killed Dread Pirate Roberts. And so when pirates like Blackbeard were finally taken and killed, the evidence was their head, and it would be taken to the nearest government agency, and they would prove that indeed they had killed this pirate, and they would then be given their reward, which would be parceled out by the captain to his crew. Piracy virtually came to an end the peak of it was 1720. By 1726, there were only a record of only 6 pirate attacks along the East Coast in 1726. In 1718, there had been 50. So it declined precipitously, and these are the reasons it declined. I don't know if they go into this at the museum or not, but let me close with this. The government in England passed legislation that said no longer did pirates have to be brought to England to be put on trial. And that was one of the problems. When they captured pirates, they had to be tried in England. They had to be tried in the Admiralty courts. And then they were hanged along London Bridge. And it was great entertainment, but you couldn't get enough pirates all the way to England to bring them to trial. So now they were allowed to try them in the courts in America. And they made short work of pirates when they were captured. I mean, short work. The trial was swift. There were no peers on the jury. pirates were not guaranteed a jury of their peers. their peers were going to hang with them is the point. And then they would be taken out and hanged for all to see. Also, they began pardoning a few. They'd capture a pirate crew. They would hang the captain and a couple of the chief lieutenants, and they would pardon the rest of the crew and tell them not to be naughty again. And that did cut down on piracy. When they actually saw the result, the men many times stopped being pirates. And then they increased naval patrols and offered rewards, large rewards, for the capture of pirates. And then, of course, the threat of execution, which was carried out in Williamsburg, Virginia, and along the coast of the Carolinas, and in Georgia, and in Florida. Captured pirates were executed without further ado. And in the end, by 1730, 1740, really, piracy had virtually been stamped out along the East Coast. But it was stamped out because of the ruthless response of the Navy and of, the anti-pirate squads that were out hunting them down. So we're going to go to a pirate museum today that was created by a man who admires pirates and loves pirates and has created a museum to remember the pirates of old. They have a certain amount of romantic interest today because of Hollywood primarily. And we need to keep in mind that we don't call evil good and good evil, because that is the trend of our culture in so many ways. We could all illustrate this with various stories on all kinds of issues and things. So it's good to see a pirate museum, but we're actually looking into the heart of depraved behavior of 300 years ago. One of the most popular movies today that won a bunch of Academy Awards is called Captain Phillips. And it's about piracy. It's about Somali pirates and what happens to pirates when they attack Americans. And it's a movie that would warm the hearts of our 18th century ancestors. So not everybody has the same, it depends on who the pirate is as to how Hollywood is going to treat him. All right, thank you, Kevin.